views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get fired up for Spirit Fire Radio, your guide to practical mindfulness and meditation. Join hosts Tim Darter and Steve Kramer and discover how to add the mechanics of meditation to your day. Watch yourself connecting in a whole new way and find the amazing moments in life's routines that often pass us by. Add to your awareness with Spirit Fire Radio. Now here's your hosts, Tim Darter and Steve Kramer.
Hello, and welcome to Spirit Fire Radio. It's nice that you could join us today. I'm Steve Kramer.
And I'm Tim Darter. And this week on the Practice of Living Awareness, we're on step two, which is tip of the nose.
Yes. So this is a very interesting step within the practice. Tip of the nose really asks someone to bring your attention back to the tip of the nose. Often in meditation, our mind wants to follow a thought and wander, and it's helpful if we can get a catchphrase, back to the tip of the nose, bring my attention back to the tip of the nose. So essentially, this step is about focus. And in the past radio shows, we've talked quite a bit about the concept of focus and what focus does for us. But this is going to be an interesting show as we're going to talk about the effects of this step and not talk about the tool in this step exactly, which is returning to the tip of the nose, but the effects. What happens when you bring your attention to the tip of the nose is you really discover the usually not noticed. As we really focus on the entry point of the breath, we notice that the breath comes from the outside of us and it moves to the inside of us. We start to notice the qualities, the dynamic qualities, and all there is to notice about the breath. The breath is always there. It's always with us. We are always breathing. But often we take that for granted and we really don't begin to experience all that can unfold in the moment as we focus on this dynamism that is the breath. And so today we have a very special guest. We are going to talk about duality and this idea of moving beyond that which we take for granted sometimes. Our guest is Dr. Dorothy Riddle, and her new book is called Moving Beyond Duality. So Dorothy does a lot of work on the harmful effects of prejudice and visioning a world free of an us versus them mentality. So if you think about it, if we've got a label for somebody, we actually think we know all that that person's about based on that label. But as we sit with them, if we were to engage with them, if we were to notice that which we usually don't notice when we are in relationship with another that we may have preconceived notions about, which would be prejudice, we can really learn quite a bit about their dynamic qualities, who they really are, what they might have to offer our experience, our exchange, our relationship, or what they're offering the world. So I know this is going to be a wonderful conversation. I can tell you that I went to a conference a couple months ago, and Dr. Riddle was one of the presenters, and it was one of my favorite presentations, and I immediately bought all three of a volume, three volumes in a series called Enough for Us All. I bought these books. I took them home. I couldn't stop looking at them. I was so inspired and had to reach out and was so thrilled that Dr. Riddle agreed to be here with us. And in doing my research, I found out that this woman has contributed so much to our world. It is almost it's mind-boggling is what it is. I can tell you that we often say within the practice of living awareness, change yourself, change the world. I know so many people that this practice has helped change their relationships, their relationship with themselves, their relationship to the present moment, and in a sense has changed their relationship with the world and changed the world. But there are people among us who are not only changing themselves, but their work is there to change ourselves. They are really working to affect change in humanity that will bring about change in humanity and changing our world as a whole. So I am just going to read a few words. Dr. Dorothy Riddle is a psychologist, social change specialist, a spiritual coach. She's chairperson of the board of directors for the School of Esoteric Studies. She's been associated with this school for over 40 years. She's written and spoken extensively on feminist spirituality, on ageless wisdom teachings, and on the importance of language in shaping how we view and understand our world. She has done so much work in that area. Her engagement and in her community and in the world focuses on building bridges of understanding amongst persons of different cultural, socioeconomic, and faith communities while working compassionately for justice and equality. She's the author of 15 books, and as I said, her most recent series is Enough for Us All. Those books include The Principle of Abundance for the Cosmic Citizen, Positive Harmfulness in Practice, and her new book, Moving Beyond Duality, which is just stellar. So, Dorothy, after all of that, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Steve.
It is really a pleasure to be here with you today, and I just thank you once again for joining us.
Well, it's an honor to be asked. Thank you.
Indeed. And I just want to tell our listeners, you know, just do a quick I'm going to stop the accolades, but just do a quick web search and on Wikipedia, just read about the work that Dr. Riddle's done. You know, if I can tell you just personally, I was a 13-year-old who knew he was a homosexual. I went to the State Library of Pennsylvania and I looked up the word homosexuality, and I was alone, a kid, a little kid, looking up just to see what is this and who am I? And you know what I found? Freud. But you know, shortly thereafter, you know, the work that you did with the American Psychological Association, which really helped change the wording around homosexual issues, that were not, you know, to say that this was not a disease, that this was not a psychiatric disorder, that this was a lifestyle. And you know, I can remember embracing that and really understanding that this is a door that was open for me that I could walk through. And the work you've done not only on those issues, but global issues on the service sector, on trade, on women's issues, just over the top. So not only am I excited to talk about this step in the practice, but just to just say thank you for the work you do for all of us.
You're welcome.
So, Dorothy, let's get right into the book. The book is called Moving Beyond Duality, mm-hmm. and you have done – you've got three books, and I'd love to hear Enough for Us All. I'd love to hear about this series right off the bat, and what is Enough for Us All? What does that phrase mean?
Well, Steve, the concept for this series came from Buckminster Fuller's comment that there actually were now enough resources for all of us. But distribution was the issue. Or, you know, we can reframe that, of course, in terms of what we think is enough, and the fact that we have a society in which more is considered to be better, always. So the concept for this series was to make visible, and that's why I think it fits so well with the theme for this particular segment, the misconceptions, to make visible the misconceptions that keep us mired in a mechanistic, mistrustful, and ultimately self-destructive worldview, and help us understand that we're actually part of an ever-evolving and abundant cosmos where we evolve primarily through cooperation and networking and not through competition and dominance. And my overwhelming preoccupation was, as you mentioned, that whole divisiveness that we create of us, them, that then results in violence. My personal, my personal preoccupation in this has always been violence, how we end violence against women and girls, which has been illegal under UN conventions since the 1970s, and it's still the number one human rights violation. So I wrote the three books. If you don't mind, I'd like to just say a few words about the other two before getting into the content of Moving Beyond Duality. Is that okay, Steve?
I would love for you to do that.
Okay. So Principles of Abundance for the Cosmic Citizen, this was the first one. It laid the framework and the foundation in terms of looking at the findings of quantum physics, metaphysics, the biological life sciences, social sciences. What is it that we know about who we actually are? And then translating that into practical tools that we could use with exercises to transform ourselves and our community and start shifting from scarcity to a sense of abundance, or from fear to a sense of joy. Then Dorothy, that, yep.
I'm so sorry if I could just jump in, because I would just love to tell the listeners right off the bat to really pay attention to the words that there are, that this is, there are practical exercises in these books that are so wonderful and helpful. So I hope I didn't interrupt at a time.
No.
I just want to let that go by, because yeah, that is such a wonderful aspect of these books, that really this is something you can take in and make very practical in your own life and in your own mind. So thank you for that, and go on.
Yeah. Well, thanks for noticing that, Steve, because to me, it's not my job, or it's not appropriate for me to tell other people how to do their lives. But what I can do is I can create exercises, ways for people to think about and apply concepts and shift from an old way of being to choices that they make for a new way of being. And that's particularly true for the second book, Positive Harmlessness in Practice, because what I became aware of in doing this work is that we actually have no shared experience of harmlessness. All spiritual traditions talk about do no harm, but it tells us what not to do. It doesn't tell us what to do. And we are surrounded in the media and in our interpersonal interactions with daily episodes of harm, from what we might think of as small bits to major destruction. And so how is it that we can shift our awareness and really start to develop that harmlessness muscle? That was what this book was about. And I actually built on the homophobia scale that I had developed before to create a harmlessness scale to help people assess themselves, and then also exercises to start shifting from being perhaps unconsciously harmful to being harmless. And so then that brings us to the third book, which was, okay, so now we know that we need to be harmless. We know that it's a challenge for us. Why is it that we still think dualistically and talk dualistically and create this us-them dynamic? Because I believe that violence can only occur when you objectify somebody else as an other, and you don't see that you are connected to them. So the book goes through five different ways in which we depersonalize ourselves and others, and then gives lots of content for how to shift that. But one of the most rewarding types of comments that I've heard from readers is that the book puts labels on things that they were somewhat uncomfortable about, but they couldn't figure out what the problem was, and really made them aware of things that they were not aware of before. So we're back to this noticing what's not usually noticed.
And I find that language has come up whenever we cover step number two, tip of the nose, and focus. I find it interesting that we always tend to have researchers or analysts on during this step. And language is such an important part of this book and of the work that you do. When you can name something, when it can be nominated, it is then in front of you. It's as if you can hold it in your hand and look at it and study it. So I really relate to this idea, or I relate to the person that said to you that I didn't know what it was. Even, and that to me says also, I didn't even know who I was. When we don't know that the words we're choosing, or that our reactions are somehow a part of, as you said earlier, the machine, that it's mechanistic. Somehow we are a part of a machine that we may not realize we can steer that machine. We've got some choice in that. We've got our own, we've got the ability to control and make choices within ourselves. So I find that language is a big part of this, first of all, and it's so well done in this book to really break down, you know, certain classifications that allow you to identify, first of all, where you are and also where a situation may be sort of, you know, where does it exist? Where does a sort of situation I find myself in? How can I wrap my thoughts around the truth of this situation and what can I do to get beyond it? Which leads me to ask you, how do we get beyond this? I know that's a big question, but if this is a machine, you know, if it's mechanistic, if these, if this sort of preoccupation with us versus them, which inevitably leads to violence. And what's interesting to me is a lot of people don't actually see it as violence when in fact it is. How do we undo that? Do we have to create a new machine, or can we sort of refit and reform the machine we've got going? How do you see this process?
Well, actually, Steve, I think that this is directly related to spiritual concepts, you know, to spiritual disciplines, because I think there's a societal level, and at the societal level, we have this paternalistic image of typically the father figure external to us who either judges us as doing well or doing poorly, and we try to, you know, manage that relationship. We take that into the spiritual realm, and we talk about divinity or deity, whatever term you want to use, as though it's external to us, and it's not. We are all part of the one life. We are And what's interesting is that quantum physics has verified what metaphysics has been saying for centuries, and that is that there is one huge energetic field. We are all part of it. Whatever we do affects everyone else. We talk about the butterfly effect. You know, you blink your eyes here, and that effect ripples through. Well, it's absolutely true, and some of the most recent research is so fascinating that, for example, you can, by noticing something, you can change what happened in the past. Now, we may know that psychologically, but from a physics point of view, you can see things shifting because of what you notice in the present. That's not the way we usually think about our world, is it?
No.
No.
And it's incredibly liberating, is it not?
Yes.
I mean, it really makes us a co-creator. We are on the
Absolutely.
Cutting edge of defining not only who we are, but the world we are creating.
That's absolutely true. So when we come to the personal level, I would say the basic thing for us personally is that we develop from a very early age, based on modeling and what we see around us, lazy habits of thinking. When I first became engaged with this topic, which was back in the 1970s, the first exercise that I set myself was that whenever I gave two options, I had to give a third, a fourth, and a fifth. And if you just try that, you know, instead of saying, shall I do this or shall I do that? Well, what's the third option you could do? What's the fourth option? What's the fifth option? You start to shift out of that really easy, quick, there's only two ways of looking at things. And that can help you open up in a way that helps you move beyond this dualistic thinking.
Wonderful. And, you know, we really in modern life are only given so many choices. It's such an ingrained, it's mechanistic is what it really is. I even go to right to sports. You know, it's so evident when so many people in our culture are really addicted to this idea of sports, and it just really affirms this us versus them. I am on this team or that team. You look at the American political system, it comes down to a two-party system. So it really is ingrained, you know, this or that, mm-hmm. as opposed to thinking we've got so many choices, and to going inside and asking ourselves, go further, and what might the next thought be, and what might the next option be, and may I even just pause for a moment to see what might come in, which brings us to meditation, does it not?
Yes, yes. And if I could just add one other aspect of this, it's another part of that lazy thinking, and that is that we develop a habit of blaming others as opposed to taking responsibility ourselves for the fact that it's our life and it's up to us to make that life work in a fulfilling way and a way that contributes to the rest of the world.
Could you say a few more sentences about the blaming aspect? I think listeners would really appreciate that.
Well, if you start listening to what's said in political rhetoric, it becomes really obvious, but it's also there in interpersonal, is this habit that we're only okay if we're better than somebody else, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to put down somebody else. We need to blame somebody else instead of saying, you can be fine and I can be fine. It's shifting from a but to an and.
Yes.
Right? From saying, you're okay and I'm okay, as opposed to I'm okay as long as you're not okay.
Yes. Incredibly limiting, the other, you know, the mm-hmm. other. There it is. It is incredibly limiting. And you realize that, especially in the American political arena, we've seen this time, it really has nothing to do with show me some ideas that will inspire me. You know, in the end, it seems to always spiral down toward this is why the other person is bad, as opposed to mm-hmm. here's what I have to offer. And what it does is then allows you to go inside and say, I like that idea. That idea aligns with my ideas. The mm-hmm. other way really does just get tit for tat.
Mm-hmm. And if I could add one more thing here, Steve.
Sure.
One of the things that helps me, that's very meaningful to me, is to remember at a very deep level that truly we are all part of this one life, in capitals, you know, O-O-L capitals. But we're each different expressions. And my personal belief is that before I came into this life, my soul set a particular task for me, a particular purpose for me in this life to achieve. And what I need to remember is I have no idea what anybody else's life path is. And I don't know why it is they are where they are. And so I need to respect them. I don't have to agree with them. I don't have to condone what they do. But I have to respect that somehow they're trying to do their life. They may have gotten off track, but they are trying to do their life. You know what I mean? So it's that willingness to be curious about what another person's life is and to respect the fact that they have a perspective and they have a purpose that may be very different from mine.
Two of my favorite words in the world, in my lifetime anyway, are curiosity and reverence. And mm-hmm. you just spoke to the two of them. You know, if I can have reverence for all living beings and all mm-hmm. that is in front of me, and I can be curious about it, isn't my every moment just wonderful? Isn't it full of wonder? You know, that's number three on my list would be the word mm-hmm. wonder. And so, mm-hmm. you know, again, it doesn't shock me that you have done wonderful work for the School of Esoteric Studies. You know, really this ageless wisdom has got its roots in Buddhism, which talks quite a bit about the soul and reincarnation and this idea that we come back again and again. And doesn't that just support this idea that if we're going to come back here again and again, and all that we do creates the world that we will come back to, don't we want to have wonderful options for coming back to a world in which we have contributed to the growth and the expansion and the creative abundance that is at hand. Wouldn't we like to come back to a garden that's in full bloom? You know, it makes perfect mm-hmm. sense. So it's just wonderful. I love this conversation, and we're going to go to a break in a minute. And when we come back, I would really love to talk a bit about meditation. And I know Tim and I had talked to Dorothy before the show, and Tim went on for quite a bit, just yeah. loved and said that you had given one of the most concise and beautiful definitions of meditation that he had ever heard. And this guy reads a lot, so that's wonderful. And I would love to talk a bit about that when we come back. But I have loved so far this conversation of duality. You know, we live in a world that has got form, and that means that we on some level are separate from the world. It means we can look at that which is in front of us, but so much connects us. And when we take a moment in meditation, especially something as simple as noticing the breath and something that was at once outside of us and as at the next moment inside of us, and realize that there is that magical moment where outside becomes inside and inside becomes outside, and magic happens. Magic happens at this step. So it is no doubt that magic has happened as you have explored this notion of duality and have just made, once again, such amazing contributions. So we're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about meditation. So we'll be right back with Spirit Fire Radio.
There are so many resources out there for meditation, but did you know that Atana's Heart Earth Healing Meditation is available for you for free? Yes, that's right. You can receive this free healing meditation today from Atana Bedili. All you need to do is visit his website, atanamethod.com. That's A-T-A-A-N-A method.com, and sign up. You will receive your free meditation instantly. That's atanamethod.com.
My play, The United States of China, is about the trial of Marian Hopkins, who is a metaphor for all that America stands for. It's the year 2018. America has become the United States of China. We've owed China trillions of dollars we cannot pay. Consequently, we default.
How long do you think it will take this financial empire to crash and crumble? Just like that.
This is more than a play experience. It's a movement to create awareness and empower people to be in action. We are strong together. We will always prevail. Get your tickets today at americathestrong.com.
Hi, I'm Tim Darter.
And I'm Steve Kramer.
Join us on Spirit Fire Radio. Discover how to add the mechanics of meditation to your day.
And watch yourself connect in a whole new way. Find the amazing moments in life's routines that often pass us by. Add to your awareness with Spirit Fire Radio.
Tune in each Wednesday at 9 a.m. for your weekly guide to practical mindfulness. And to learn more, visit www.spiritfireradio.com.
Get into it for 2016. Do you want more prosperity, clarity, energy, and balance in your life? Join Lynn Brown now through March for one of her amazing workshops, each focusing on a key part of living your best life. For more information and to register for one of these amazing workshops, visit lynnbrownevent.com. That's lynnbrownevent.com. And get into it this 2016 with Lynn Brown.
Hi, this is Leslie Fontaine, and my show is Sheer Alchemy on TransformationTalkRadio.com. When we're bogged down with our emotions, the hardships that plague us in our relationships, at work, our finances, we literally can't see the higher plane where we could be operating from. Tune in to Leslie Fontaine, Sheer Alchemy, on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Welcome back to Spirit Fire Radio, where today we're talking with Dr. Dorothy Riddle.
Dr. Riddle, it's just been a great conversation thus far. Before the break, we brought it back to meditation, which I love to do. And we had told listeners that when we had spoken before the show that you gave such a really compelling definition of meditation. So I'd love if you could share that with us all for all the listeners.
Sure, no problem. To me, it goes back. It's seated in or situated in the fact that we are all part of this energy field. And so how we connect with that energy and what we contribute is really important. And to me, the purpose of meditation is it's not an end in itself. It's a discipline for working with energy. And it through meditation, we learn how to focus in a way where we can receive in a way that's not distorted, and we can contribute in a way that's not distorted. And we practice that in the breath, which is so interesting that this is, you know, what we're talking about today. We have that pattern of interludes where we take in, we have the intention that brings it in. Then we have a point of tension where we hold it, the high interlude. Then we release it, hopefully in a focused way. And then we have the pause, the rest. And that is the pattern of the world. If you think about like the sea, the tides, if you think about change and creation, that there's that buildup, there's that holding, consolidation. There's the release, and we need all of that. So in meditation, to me, we are learning the pattern of how to work with energy. And we are also, at some point, there are different points in the practice, but I just wanted to comment because you were talking before about boundaries or something that, for me, set off thoughts about boundaries. That within the Ageless Wisdom, we talk about the concept of ring pass not. In order to hold energy and tension, which is what we do at the high interlude of meditation, we have to put a boundary around it. We have to be able to encapsulate it in some kind of way. Otherwise, it just fizzles away. And so learning to create that boundary that holds the energy so that we can then release it creatively and in a way that's constructive, to me, is also one of the important aspects of meditation.
And can you, if you will, relate that in a sense to, I'm just going to say it, to prejudice? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that sounds so far-fetched, but what I'm hearing is when we do create that point of tension and we put a boundary around it, in a sense, sometimes that is what we are doing in labeling, or it's what we are doing in creating a belief system. And there's that opportunity once, and please correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. There's what happens is when we've got that point of tension, there are options for distortions that may come in at that point. And it may not be at that point. It may be at many, many points. But certainly when we're in the realm of the mind, we've got belief system. We've got illusion. We've got a concept that may not be our own truth or a truth, but it is a belief that we have held on to that may contain distortion. So within a point of tension, if something is contained, we then need to release it. And mm-hmm. is that a process that is happening as we come to notice the usually not noticed or allow ourselves – in noticing the usually not noticed, I find what we're actually doing is releasing. We are releasing tension, or we are releasing a contraction around the opposite of noticing the not noticed, which is presumption.
Mm-hmm.
Am I on a limb somewhere?
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. Let me put it just slightly differently. The way I would think about it is that we have, if you think about the concept of distortion, which is a little bit less emotionally laden for us than some other words we might use. If we are not careful, what we take in are distortions. So we take in beliefs that are inaccurate, and that's a basis for prejudice, right? It's certainly a basis for stereotype. Now, there are a lot of ways that we depersonalize, but that's one of the ways, important ways in which we do it. So we need to learn to notice distortions, to ask questions. You know, why is it that I would believe that? Why is it that people assume that things have to be that way? And then when we take it in and we're holding it, when I talk about boundary or ring pass knot, that's not necessarily non-porous. The image that I use that's helpful for me is the image of the semi-permeable membrane that cells have that let in the things that are healthy. I mean, if the cell's healthy, that let in the things that are healthy and keep out the things that are not healthy. So we can create and nurture a porous membrane that allows us to question and to change what it is that we're holding, so that when we release, we don't harm others.
I appreciate. Does that make sense? I appreciate that so much. And if I can just bring that back to meditation, that is for me, and I can only speak for myself, you know, that is the joy, and that is the work of meditation. It is really finding that clarity within my, at least I would say, you know, my mental space, but really the clarity within all of my emotional body, my physical body. Really, it is creating alignment that enables clarity, that I now, after hearing you put it so beautifully, that allows for that porous, beautiful, healthy cell membrane of my mind to allow distortions to sort of, to allow clarity in, which then clears out any distortion. So, you know, when you said the words take in, immediate as my mind was saying, yes, we sometimes will take a thought or a pondering or a belief, take it into meditation. And that is really taking it into a space that is clear, that offers clarity and therefore offers solution, offers, you know, a spiraling up or sort of a, you know, a higher vibration take on any given situation or thought.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
I agree absolutely. One of the things that we need to be cautious about, you were talking about illusions before, is that as humanity, we have created massive negative thought forms, massive thought forms that hold prejudice and stereotypes in place. You know, if you think the same thing over and over and over again, you got lots of people, it generates that. So one of the challenges is you can't just be open to and assume that whatever's out there is wonderful, glorious, you know. You have to be thoughtful. You have to be reflective. You have to be discriminating, which is one of the spiritual qualities, right? Discrimination of what is truth and what is not.
And you know, you have to be able to create space. I can give you two very simple examples that as I was pondering this show, I share a space, not any longer. I used to share a space with two individuals. And when I first moved here to run this nonprofit, I lived with two individuals, and I lived with them for – these are both adults, a man and a woman and myself, and I lived here for a year. And after a year, one of them, who's probably in her 60s, looked at me and said, "So what's it like living with two straight people?" And I just laughed, and I thought, straight people, what does that mean? Like, two straight, like, I never even thought of them in terms of their sexual preference. This labeling of the word of them as straight seems so almost archaic to me. I thought, well, I know you as such vibrant, amazing individuals. But what's beautiful about that situation is when that was said to me, I first smiled and laughed because it just felt so absurd. And I gave myself space with it. You know, I laughed. I didn't respond right away. And I'm happy to say that that's the result of a spiritual practice and of meditation, mm-hmm. of creating space and going, well, that was strange. And instead of reacting right away, like, hey, if you're calling yourself straight, does that mean you're judging me as being the other? And what does that mean? And what do you think about mm-hmm. me going on this whole, you know, this huge, you know, I just created space, laughed, and we talked about it in terms of, wow, that's so interesting. I think this is a generational thing. And beyond that, Tim and I, you know, and here's one that I'd love to hear your comment on. Tim and I are in the kitchen all the time cooking, and we're often working with yoga groups. And we've got one particular group that's called Yoga Moms, and they're all moms, and they come for a weekend to just be with each other and to practice yoga and really enjoy meditative space, really without their kids and their family and just enjoying themselves. And recently they saw Tim and I in the other room, and they laughed and they said, look, two men cooking for the women. And the women all laughed and thought it was funny. And I just thought, wow, you know, that's really interesting that everyone laughs and thinks it's funny, but really there's great bit of stereotyping going on there that mm-hmm. we're the men cooking for the women. And I thought later, you know, what will it take for us as a humanity to get to the point where we don't even make fun of that sort of thing? You know, I've all got a huge thing with humor and reasons why we laugh, and I won't even go into that. That's another radio show. But could we get to the point where instead of saying and making a joke out of, look, two men cooking for the women, could we get to the point where we look in the other room and we say, thank you, it's really nice for someone to cook for me this weekend. I really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. So simple and so liberating and so honest. Yes. So within go on.
Yeah, but you're touching on several dynamics that are deeply embedded in our society and that need to change. Yes. One of them is the most fundamental duality that we create is gender. And there's a lot of conversation about that these days, which is great. But underlying a lot of that conversation is still an assumption that there are two good ways or two right ways of being in the world, as opposed to gender just being something like the color of your hair or the length of your toenails or, you know, something like that. So you've got, because we make gender so basic in terms of how we stereotype, what we can see as gender role violation makes us very uncomfortable. And interestingly enough, for example, the early research on homophobia demonstrated that homophobia wasn't about sex. It was about gender role violation. Men acting like women, women acting like men. That was what got people really agitated. Yes. So you've got a violation of that role. But you've also got, there's another duality that we create that is related to stereotyping, and that is either you are warm and nurturing, which is classically identified with female, or you are competent, which is associated with male. And there's one of the dynamics that I explore in my book is called benevolent bigotry. And this is the paternalism that gets expressed primarily towards women, although towards other groups as well. And it is they show over and over again in the experiments that if a woman is seen as competent, she is assumed to be not warm. She's assumed to be cold, to be domineering, all of those kinds of things. If she is seen as warm or nurturing, then she is assumed to be not competent. So that's another dynamic that's coming in. Yes. And then there's a third one I just would like to mention, and that is go ahead. Sorry.
If I could just jump in, not only are those assumptions, but she is asked to defend herself against that.
Yes. Yes.
you know, I just want to add that because it gets me a little riled up.
And we certainly saw that with
Hillary Clinton. We're not going to go there, but we certainly really did see that, where it was not only an accusation, but then having to defend yourself somehow puts a stamp on it. And it's,
that's right.
It's just unnerving. But go on.
Yeah. Well, and I've dealt with this all my professional life. There are many contexts in which I am only accepted as the expert that I am if there's a male that says that I am, you know, that kind of condones me or puts the seal of approval on me. But the third dynamic, which I think is also really important for us to keep in mind, is in terms of objectification. Objectification is about seeing another individual only in terms of their usefulness to us, not as an individual in and of themselves with their own life. And we tend to see service providers, which is what you and Tim are doing when you're cooking, as these kind of invisible objects. And so you have these women who know you in another role. They can't just, they can't think of you just as service providers, but yet you are acting in that role. So that creates another tension. And I just, if I may, I just want to offer another exercise that people can do to become aware of this. And that is, please, when you're in a situation where you are receiving service, whether it's at the grocery store, it's the plumber that comes to the house or whatever, address the person by name. So this is a habit that I do. If I don't know the person's name, I ask them what their name is, and then I say, well, thank you, Louise, or thank you, James, or whatever it is. And it's amazing how often people respond to that. They kind of blossom.
Oh. Like
you've seen them for themselves, not just for the role that they're in that's useful to you.
And I can feel that. I can feel my heart open as soon as you say that. You know, and I have to say, we just had somebody here today working on our furnace. and I just, at the moment you said that, I realized that I did not do that. And this was such a kind gentleman with the kindest eyes, the nicest smile, so courteous. And if I had just asked his name, we had many exchanges, it would have been that much more meaningful. And how wonderful that would be to exercise that would have been. And now the next thing is to not criticize oneself too much for not
doing it.
But just say, hey, I have options now for the next time. It's so liberating.
Exactly. Wow.
Beautiful, beautiful. With, you know, just such wonderful conversation. I wanted to just let listeners know. You know, here's you mentioned objectification. And again, I would just like to repeat what you said. And it is only seeing someone for what it is they're offering us. For instance, we need our furnace cleaned, and that was all I focused was, here's the task you are going to do, and it takes the human quality out of it, and it really is so selfish that, well, okay, I'm really just want my furnace cleaned, and I'm on to the next thing. And I'm so limiting, so I've learned something, and I'm sure that will stay with me. But, you know, back to I could go so many places. The homophobia scale that you created, which is actually called the Riddle Homophobia Scale, I mean, this is used by organizations, and it's used for anti-discriminatory training. And, you know, this, you could take this test online, and I would offer listeners this, just to go online and do a Google search, and you can actually take this yourself, and don't even look at it in terms of homophobia. And I'm sure that you know that people have used, you said not only the homophobia scale, but also the, could you say the other scale that was created?
I've created the harmlessness scale, which is in the book, Positive Harmlessness in Practice.
So, you know, these books are so chock full of exercises, just like the one that we just covered, which just changed me. You know, I know now I will hold that at the forefront of my consciousness. And the next time I'm presented with a situation like that, I'm going to try it out. And I'm just so certain that it will change the way I approach people. But the books are so full of just incredible, really thought-provoking terms. You know, hostile bigotry. You know, I'm going to list for this one aspect of the book: hostile bigotry, benevolent bigotry, stereotyping, invisibility, objectification. You have spent so much time analyzing these words and what is the energy behind these words. And it's so important that we choose our words. We put a word out there and it is really, I would say it's like putting a chair into a living room. You put a word out there and the vibration of that word is now a part of the mental fabric. It is part of the, it is mind stuff that we all have to sort through. So we need to be so careful with our words. And one thing I love about your books is that, especially looking at that homophobia scale, to see all of the work that has gone into processing the various levels which show where somebody may be upon this scale, that says, really what it's saying is, where are you in your process of evolution? Mm-hmm. How are you sort of evolving into a human being that is really at that point of pure co-creatorship in creating a world where we embrace, we respect, and we are actually working with as opposed to against every person we come in contact with? It's so liberating. Just such beautiful work. I don't know if there's anything you want to say on that.
Well, thank you. I do. We've commented. I think hostile bigotry speaks for itself. I mean, that's the very, very damaging work that we things that we do to other people. Not only physical violence, but also harassment, bullying, all of that. We've mentioned benevolent bigotry, which is the paternalism and stereotyping and objectification. So I just want to say a word about invisibility or dismissiveness, because we do this to ourselves. We have a feeling, we have an intuition that something's important, and then we dismiss it. We say, oh no, I must be wrong. We don't take ourselves seriously. So that's one perspective. But with other people, I just wanted to share one of the episodes, which is in the book, that Richard Gere was filming a film on homelessness, and they didn't know if they would be able to film in New York City where he lives. He's a very visible, well-known actor, and they wanted to film him sitting as a beggar on the street, and they didn't know if that would work. They had the cameras away, hidden. He sat there begging with a cup out for 40 minutes. And nobody recognized him. Nobody spoke to him. Nobody interacted with him in any way. And he said, he himself, I believe, is a practicing Buddhist. He said it was a soul-destroying experience.
Wow. Wow.
To be there and be completely invisible to people around him. And, of course, the homeless are one of the groups that we do that with, or the poor. We try to distance ourselves. Also, persons with disabilities. There are other groups where this comes in. But for ourselves, we can start with not being invisible to ourselves, and
beautiful.
That's the noticing what we don't usually notice.
Beautiful. And I just want to say, it's what I love about this show. We take a step of the practice, and we're talking something so simply about the breath. We're saying, listen, bring your focus to the tip of the nose and start to notice your breath. There is so much there. And what I love about this show is we invite guests on the show who take that tool and they make it their life's mission, their life's passion, or they have done that. And we get to learn so much about the show by talking to them about what it is that they do. And you have, within this show, just told us so much about noticing the usually not noticed. So we just have a few minutes left. And Dr. Riddle, I just want to first of all thank you before we come to the end for this just incredibly, I learned a lot. I'm leaving a changed man. So that's the power behind your words and your work. But I want to let the listeners know that they can go to enoughforusall.com. And that's, I'm going to say it again, enoughforusall.com. And this series of books, Enough for Us All, is just amazing. Mine, I've owned them for a month and they're already folded at the edges. They're curled around from me carrying them around with me. They're amazing books with wonderful practices. So teachers, healers, psychiatrists, whoever, moms, these books are just so full of wonderful exercises and so much work, so much hard work and analysis and, you know, has just gone into this. So, Dorothy, anything you'd like to tell people before we wrap it up?
I just want to make one comment because you're emphasizing the exercises, which to me is one of the important rich parts of the book. These books do exist as ebooks. You can certainly purchase and download them as ebooks, and I know people have gotten used to doing that. But the ebooks are abridged. They do not have the exercises in them.
Yes, very good.
And so if you want the full benefit, then I would encourage you. They're available on any of the online ordering places that you like to use, or get your local bookstore to order them in.
Yes, we will certainly carry them at our bookstore. Yeah. We're very excited about that. And I would say, indeed, listeners, if this conversation has inspired you, the books themselves, they're beautifully written. They're in a really wonderful font that makes them easy to read. They're really great to actually have in your hands. So please, by all means, check them out. So enough for us all. We're going to wrap up the show. It's been such a delight. And listeners, the step of the practice is tip of the nose. It's online, spiritfire.com or livingawarenessmeditation.net. is our blog to find out and listen to those meditations. So thanks again, Dorothy. It's been great to be with you.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Bye, listeners. We will see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Spirit Fire Radio. Tune in each Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, 12 noon Eastern, for your weekly guide to meditation and living with awareness. Join hosts Tim Darter and Steve Kramer and discover the ways that consciousness is being cultivated in everyday life. Connect to your day in a whole new way and find the amazing moments in life's routines that often pass us by. Add to your awareness with Spirit Fire Radio. To learn more about Spirit Fire, visit spiritfireradio.com.